Hello, and welcome to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. We'll start with the death notices and move on to business and sports, then the opinions and editorials, and finish up with today's horoscopes, Dear Abby, and the comics. The death notices from today's Arizona Republic: Roger Lee Adams, age 81, from Mesa; Beverly June Teeters Borders, age 87, from Phoenix; Ardith Carley, age 69, from Apache Junction; John Joseph Collins Sr., age 82, from Sun City; Michael Joseph Lighting, age 79, from Phoenix; Catherine D. Reddy, age 89, from Phoenix; Robert Torres Sierra, age 88, from Surprise; and Steve Thomas, age 90, from Phoenix. Turning now to the business section of today's Arizona Republic, Shopify must face data privacy lawsuit. Judges are split on decision to revive class action case. A U.S. appeals court on April 21st revived a proposed data privacy class action against Shopify in a decision that could make it easier for American courts to assert jurisdiction over internet-based platforms. In a 10-to-1 decision, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco said the Canadian e-commerce company can be sued in California for collecting personal identifying data from people who buy things on websites of retailers from that state. Brandon Briskin, a California resident, said Shopify installed tracking software known as cookies on his iPhone without his consent when he bought athletic wear from the retailer I Am Becoming and used his data to create a profile it could sell to other merchants. Shopify said it should not be sued in California because it operates in nationwide and did not aim its conduct toward that state. The Ottawa-based company said Briskin could sue in Delaware, New York, or Canada. A lower court judge and a 3-judge Ninth Circuit panel had agreed the case should be dismissed, but the full appeals court said Shopify expressly aimed its conduct toward California. Shopify deliberately reached out by knowingly installing tracking software onto unsuspecting Californians' phones so that it could later sell the data it obtained in a manner that was neither random, isolated, or fortuitous. Circuit Judge Kim McLean Wardlaw wrote for the majority. Lawyers for Shopify and Briskin did not immediately respond to requests for comment. A bipartisan group of 30 states plus Washington, D.C. sided with Briskin. They said they needed an ability to enforce their own consumer protection laws against companies that avail themselves of local marketplaces through the internet. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce supported Shopify, saying a broad grant of jurisdiction would harm back-end service providers whose software is used worldwide. Circuit Judge Consuelo Callahan dissented, criticizing the majority's traveling cookie rule because it, quote, impermissibly manufactures jurisdiction wherever the plaintiff goes. And continuing with the business section, Nintendo is set to launch Switch 2 amid trade war. Plans to keep price at $449.99 despite duties. Nintendo's Switch became a source of much-needed escapism during the pandemic restrictions. Now, the Japanese video game company faces the harsh reality of a brutal trade war as it launches its successor device. The Switch 2 is set to debut on June 5th. That is 8 years after the original Switch, which has sold 150 million units and disproved naysayers who predicted the decline of the console. While the trade war has put the focus on industries such as cars and chips, the maker of Super Mario and Donkey Kong games must also grapple with tariffs disrupting its business. For Nintendo, trade barriers complicate one of the hottest product launches of this year, as the success of the Switch 2 is vital for the future profitability of the company. The Switch 2 launch will test Nintendo's ability to manage its supply chain as it works to secure sufficient supply for the United States while maintaining the $449.99 price tag. If the tariffs are really going to hit them, they probably still need to raise the price for the Switch 2, said Serkan Toto, founder of the Kantan Games consultancy. Nintendo announced the device's price and launch date on April 2nd, the same day President Trump unveiled sweeping import tariffs after an initial reveal in January. The company then paused the start of the U.S. pre-orders as it examines the impact of tariffs before announcing it would maintain Switch 2 pricing with pre-orders beginning on April 24th. Nintendo hiked the cost of some accessories and said in a statement other adjustments are also possible in the future, depending on market conditions. The accessory price hikes can only soften the blow to some extent, Toto said. The company has experienced supply chain ructions in the past, with production not limited to China, which has been hit with 145% tariffs on goods entering the United States. Nintendo plans to supply the U.S. from Vietnam and Cambodia production under normal demand assumptions, said Robin Zhu, an analyst at asset management firm Bernstein. Vietnam and Cambodia also have been hit with tariffs, though for the higher levies have been paused for 90 days. The United States is a major market for Nintendo, with the Americas making up 44% of Nintendo's sales in the financial year that ended in March. Even in the bear case, where Nintendo faces reciprocal tariffs of 46% in Vietnam and 49% in Cambodia, I'm assuming they will have to absorb that cost, said Jay Defebaugh, an analyst at the investment group CLSA. Ampere Analysis forecasts sales of 4.6 million Switch 2 units in the United States in 2025, out of 13.2 million units globally. I don't think momentum will be impacted in North America, said Piers Harding Rolls, an analyst at Ampere Analysis. Experts said hardcore fans would buy the Switch even at higher prices, but a hike could risk sapping demand among the casual players who turned the original Switch into a mega hit. The sticker price of new game hardware is seen as one of the most important factors determining success, with the price of the original Switch also closely scrutinized. Gamers have been complaining about the 50% price rise compared to the Switch and higher cost of new software such as $79.99 Mario Kart World. The Switch 2 price tag is seen by some analysts as already factoring in uncertainty over the trade war. Nintendo has a wealth of experience in managing the supply chain, said CLSA's Defebaugh. The expansion of tech giants into gaming and the growth of mobile led some observers to question the need for bulky hardware. However, Nintendo and Sony continued to hold a leading role in the industry. Earlier this month, Sony hiked prices of its PlayStation 5 in Europe and Britain, with some analysts expecting price rises in the United States. The launch of the PlayStation 5 was disrupted by COVID-19 pandemic, affecting sales earlier in the cycle. Analysts are generally positive about the prospects for the Switch 2, which offers continuity from its predecessor with a larger screen and better graphics. There's a lot of pent-up demand for a more powerful Switch experience, said Ampere's Harding Rolls. And the last article on this business section, Sun's owner's mortgage firm is sued by Ohio Attorney General. This was written by Catherine Rieger for the Arizona Republic. The Ohio Attorney General is suing United Wholesale Mortgage, led by Phoenix Suns owner Matt Ishbia, accusing the Michigan-based lender of falsely claiming that the mortgage brokers it works with are independent and saving borrowers money. Buying a home is hard enough without having to worry about a lender scheming behind your back, said Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost in a statement. This predatory business practice has no place in Ohio. The mortgage company colluded with brokers to charge borrowers above market rates and fees, according to the lawsuit. Ishbia is chairman and CEO of the lender, also known as UWM. thousands of unsuspecting borrowers did not obtain any such independent advice or representation, alleges the suit. Rather, they were ensnared in UWM's scheme, steered without their knowledge to UWM's higher price loans. A statement from UWM said the company had no prior knowledge or warning of this lawsuit filed by the Ohio Attorney General, which is in and of itself suspicious. It essentially repeats the frivolous allegations contained in a virtually identical lawsuit filed last year by a law firm that has a business arrangement with a hedge fund. The lender said it was moving to dismiss the claims. Last year, UWM was sued by some consumers alleging a fraud scheme. They claimed UWM put pressure on brokers to bring the lender borrowers who thought they were getting the best rates and fees, but that wasn't always the case, said the complaint. The pending lawsuit accused UWM and Ishbia of racketeering and violating federal and various state laws by working with mortgage brokers to steer clients UWM's way. The lender said it would defend those allegations to the fullest extent permitted by law. Turning now to the sports section of today's Arizona Republic, top of the page headline, Puck to seek multiple opinions. The Arizona Diamondbacks did not offer specifics on left-hander A.J. Puck's MRI results, but the latest development was concerning. Diamondbacks manager Torey Lovello said Puck, who had tests on his left elbow on April 22nd, will seek multiple opinions before determining how to proceed. Lovello would not say what the initial reading of the tests were, but did reveal that Puck was seeking additional opinions from Dr. Keith Meister and Dr. Neil Elatache, two of the industry's most respected orthopedic surgeons. There's no information right now. We're still gathering information, Lovello said. We want to be as thorough as possible. When imaging is done, you get other opinions. You just want to make sure you hit it right. This is a really important situation. They all are. Puck, 29, was placed on the injured list April 19th due to left elbow inflammation. He said last week his arm felt tight during his appearance on April 17th in Miami and that the tightness had not improved by the next day. Puck was an integral part of the club's bullpen last season after being acquired in a July trade with the Marlins. He logged a 1.32 ERA in 30 appearances with the Diamondbacks. He had a 3.38 ERA in 8 innings this season. Lovello and Meister and Elatache represent second and third opinions. Puck has one Tommy John surgery in his history, a procedure he underwent in 2018. I'm going to remain as optimistic as possible, Lovello said. Lovello said he wanted outfielder Jake McCarthy, who was optioned to AAA Reno after the game April 20th, to treat his time in the minors as an extended road trip, after which he hopes to make a swift return to the majors. What I told him is, Lovello said, look at it like you're going on a 2 or 3 week road trip and get your butt back here as soon as possible. Lovello added, he wasn't comfortable with the decision. I didn't expect him to be comfortable with the decision. But I know Jake is built on the right things and he's going to find his way back here. Because I do believe, and I will say this, like I've said every year, our best outfield and our best team has Jake on it. McCarthy went just 3-for-41, that's .073, to start the season, opening the year hitless in his first 24 at-bats. Just as troubling, Lovello said, was the organization's belief that some of his offensive struggles were leaking into other parts of his game. There were some mistakes being made around his game that we felt like it was all connected, Lovello said. Once you're there struggling, and it's before you and it starts to trickle into other parts of your game, such as the pickoffs or some of the plays he was failing to make on defense, we couldn't help but start to take notice that maybe a little bit of a reboot might matter to him. In McCarthy's absence, Lovello said Alec Thomas likely would receive the bulk of the playing time in center field, likely getting all of the starts against right-handed pitching. Outfielder Jorge Barroza, a switch hitter who was recalled to take McCarthy's place on the roster, could see starts against lefties. And second baseman Ketel Marte continues to progress through a hamstring strain and is expected to begin running the bases this week, Lovello said. All the targets we wanted to hit with Ketel have been reached, Lovello said, and we continue to push him downfield. The club has been targeting a late April, early May return from the injured list for Marte. Right-hander Kevin Ginkle threw 24 pitches on April 21st in an extended spring training game and will make his next appearance on April 24th when he starts a minor league rehab assignment with AAA Reno, Lovello said. Ginkle has been sidelined by right shoulder inflammation. And right-hander Kendall Graveman, who battled back discomfort for much of spring training, faced hitters for the second time in a live batting practice situation on April 22nd. He's expected to progress to an extended spring game on April 26th, Lovello said. And tonight, the Diamondbacks are playing at 6:40 p.m. E. Rodriguez is pitching versus Taj Bradley, right-handed pitcher with a 5.24 ERA. At Chase Field, Rodriguez gave up 3 runs, 1 earned in 5 1/3 innings against the Marlins last week in Miami, walking none and striking out 9. In 22 innings this season, Rodriguez has 29 strikeouts compared to only 6 walks. Rodriguez has ugly career numbers against the Rays, posting a 5.55 ERA in 15 starts. He has struggled in extensive experience against first base Yandy Diaz and second baseman Brandon Lowe. Bradley was hit hard in his most recent start, giving up 6 runs in 5 1/3 innings in a loss to the Yankees. He's thrown fairly well in 3 starts prior to that. And games coming up Thursday, April 24th at Chase Field, 6:40, Diamondbacks right-handed pitcher Corbin Burns against the Rays. On Friday, April 25th at Chase Field, Diamondbacks right-hand pitcher Zach Gallen against the Braves left-handed pitcher Chris Sale. And Saturday, April 26th at Chase Field, 5:10, Diamondbacks right-handed pitcher Merrill Kelly versus the Braves right-handed pitcher Grant Holmes. Turning to basketball, also on the front page of the sports section, where will Phoenix Suns pick in NBA draft? It's written by Dwayne Rankin for the Arizona Republic. The Phoenix Suns have the 29th overall pick in the first round and the 52nd pick in the second round of the 2025 draft, June 25th, 26th, at Barclays Center in Brooklyn, New York. The NBA announced the draft order selection on Monday, April 21st, after determining 5 tiebreakers through random drawings conducted by NBA President of League Operations, Byron Spruill, at the league office in Secaucus, New Jersey. Mark Dielli, a partner from Ernst & Young, an accounting firm, oversaw the tiebreaker process. Phoenix was in a similar position last year and landed eventual rotational players Ryan Dunn and Oso Iguodaro in day draft trades. So who might they land this year? CBS Sports projects the Suns will draft LeBaron Fillon, in the first round this year. A 6'4" freshman point guard out of Alabama, Fillon averaged 10.6 points on 45.2% shooting. He led the Crimson Tide 28-9 in steals with 50 and was second in assists with 140 to 64 turnovers. Sports Illustrated has Phoenix using its first-round pick to take Michigan junior 7-footer Danny Wolfe in the first round and nabbing Darion Williams in the second round. Wolfe averaged 13.2 points on 49.7% shooting and 9.7 rebounds in his one season with the Wolverines, 27-10, after spending 2 years at Yale. Williams averaged a career-high 15.1 points in his second season at Texas Tech, 28-9, after starting his college career at Nevada in 2022-23. The 6'6" forward entered the draft as well as the transfer portal in maintaining his NCAA eligibility. Last season, the Suns chose Daron Holmes II with his 22nd overall pick in the first round and traded his draft rights to Denver for the draft rights of Dunn, who the Nuggets took 28th overall, and 3 second-round picks, 2024, 2026, and 2031. The next day, they acquired the draft rights to Iguodaro, the 40th overall pick in the second round, from the New York Knicks in exchange for the draft rights to Kevin McCullough Jr., the 56th overall pick, and the Boston Celtics' 2028 protected second-round pick. Dunn started 44 of the 74 games he played in this season, averaging 6.9 points and 3.6 rebounds, while Iguodaro averaged 4.2 points and 3.6 rebounds in 61 games, 6 starts, this season. The 6'8 Dunn took on the challenge of being the team's top on-ball defender, and the 6'10 Iguodaro displayed budding skills as a passer on screens and finishing around the rim. He shot 60.4% from the field. Iguodaro spent 4 years at Marquette. Dunn played at Virginia for 2 years. Phoenix's 29th pick this year came from a deal before the 2025 trade deadline. The Suns sent their unprotected 2031 first-round pick to Utah for the least favorable first-round picks between the Cleveland Cavaliers, Minnesota Timberwolves, and Jazz in 2025, 2027, and 2029. The Cavs wound up being the least favorable as they finished with the NBA's second-best record at 64-18. To have the 29th pick, which now belongs to Phoenix. Phoenix acquired the 52nd pick in the second round from Charlotte in the Nick Richards deal before the trade deadline that sent Josh Okogie to the Hornets. Houston's lottery pick is from Brooklyn's first-round selection the Nets received from Phoenix in the Kevin Durant trade before the 2023 deadline. Washington's second-round selection is the Bradley Beal deal, involving Chris Paul in the summer of 2023. The Suns failed to make the playoffs in the 2024-25 season, finishing 36-46, marking their first losing season since 2019-20. The last time they missed the postseason, they fired Mike Budenholzer the day after their final game, April 13th at Sacramento. Budenholzer only coached the Suns one season after signing a 5-year deal for more than $50 million. Phoenix will hire its fourth head coach in 4 seasons under team owner Matt Ishbia. And also in basketball, Mercury Television's schedule is released. The Phoenix Mercury released their 2025 regular season's local and national TV broadcast schedule on Monday, April 21st. There will be 36 games aired, the most in franchise history, on Arizona's Family, Channel 3, and streaming Mercury Live. That includes Phoenix's 2 preseason contests at the Las Vegas Aces on May 6th and hosting WNBA expansion team Golden State Valkyries on May 11th. 8 games will be exclusive, nationally televised matchups. ABC will show Phoenix at the Chicago Sky on June 21st and the remaining 7 aired by ION. 6 games will be simulcast on Arizona's Family and Amazon Prime. 2 will air on ESPN3 at last season's WNBA Finals runner-up Minnesota Lynx on June 3rd and at the Caitlin Clark-led Indiana Fever on July 30th. The Fever play at the Mercury on August 7th, which will be televised on 3TV. Phoenix regular season begins at home against the Seattle Storm on May 17th, followed by the Los Angeles Sparks on May 21st, both at Phoenix Arena. The Mercury's first road game is May 23rd at Seattle. And turning to football, Cardinals are in a good spot entering the NFL draft. This is written by Theo Mackey from the Arizona Republic. Back in February, when all this began, Monty Ossenfort offered up a bold ambition for the Arizona Cardinals draft process. "What we're trying to do," the Cardinals general manager said, "is when we get through free agency, can we go out and play a game? And why is that so important? We don't want to go into a draft saying we absolutely have to draft this position to fill this need," Ossenfort explained. "That's a tough place to be in." 2 months later, the draft is here, and Ossenfort's vision has become a reality. When he held the news conference back in February, there were at least 4 positions that would have made the Cardinals uneasy. Now, they could, if necessary, feel comfortable entertaining the season with their current group at every position on the roster. The marquee free agent signing of Josh Sweat negates their need at edge rusher. Likewise, Dalvin Tomlinson and Calais Campbell arrived at defensive tackle, providing enough veteran presence at a previously dire position. Evan Brown re-signed for 2 years to hold down the left guard. Akeem Davis-Gaither was added as Kazir White's replacement at middle linebacker. Last week, Austin Fort acknowledged that the Cardinals still certainly have places where we want to add. But in the same breath, he said, really, in the end, we want to add good football players. That's particularly beneficial in this draft, both because of the Cardinals' draft spot and the crop of players available. Last spring, they desperately needed a wide receiver. That was okay because they held the fourth overall pick and knew Marvin Harrison Jr. would likely be available for them. This year, more flexibility is needed. After the first five or so picks, this draft is widely considered to have a relatively flat talent level through the first round. The quality of players at pick 10 is not expected to be drastically different from the quality of players available at pick 30. That makes the draft less predictable than typical. The Cardinals have to be prepared for the picks in front of them to fall in all sorts of directions. It's hard to predict, Austin Fort said. We'll do a few exercises this week where we try to take a look at what we think's going to happen. But in reality, there's 32 teams, and their boards look 32 different ways. Challenges? Yeah. But really, it's just staying flexible and being ready to have options for whatever comes our way. And we'll be ready to do that at 16. If they desperately needed a specific position, they wouldn't be able to welcome that flexibility. Now they can let the board fall and take whichever player they deem to be the most valuable asset. I learned a long time ago that what isn't perceived as a need 1 year, and fast forward a year later, all of a sudden, it is a need, Austin Fort said. So I think no matter where it is, if we can add an impact player that checks boxes for us on and off the field, it's never going to be a bad pick. It's still unlikely that the Cardinals would entirely ignore positional value. Ends Tyler Warren and Colston Loveland are unlikely fits because Arizona already has an elite tight end in Trey McBride, plus viable depth. Likewise for safeties, Malachi Starks and Nick Emmanuel, given that their roster already features Budda Baker and Jalen Thompson. But just about anyone else could be an option for the Cardinals, as could trading out of the 16th pick. Imagine if Shedeur Sanders is still available and quarterback needy general managers begin calling Austin Fort. He'll be in a position to listen to offers without worrying about a position of need drying up. It's an enviable spot, just as Austin Fort imagined 2 months ago. And staying with the sports section, we'll take a look at the Arizona Digest. ASU hockey forward is named to Team USA. Arizona State forward Cullen Potter was named to Team USA's 25-man roster for the upcoming Under-18 Men's World Championship in Frisco and Allen, Texas. In his freshman season, Potter registered 22 points, 13 goals, and 9 assists in 35 games. The U.S. begins preliminary round play on April 23rd against Czechia. The tournament runs until May 3rd, 2025. And an ASU baseball update, the Arizona State baseball team took 2 of the 3 games against Texas Tech in a bizarre homestand. The Sun Devils, 25-15, 11-7, Big 12, had the second game suspended in the 7th inning due to rain and field conditions, forcing a doubleheader the next day on April 19th. ASU won 9-8 after being tied 7-7, but dropped the finale 12-8. Kyle Walker extended his on-base streak to 29 games and has recorded a hit in 11 of the last 22 games since becoming the leadoff batter. ASU will next play at Grand Canyon on April 22nd. And the Phoenix Rising Football Club rallies for draw versus Sacramento Republic. In a rare afternoon game, Rising came back from a 2-goal deficit to earn a 2-2 draw with Sacramento Republic on April 19th at Phoenix Rising Stadium. For a second time this season, Phoenix came back from a 2-goal deficit to earn a result. Forwards Gerald Margarita and Damian Rivera scored goals, while forward Remy Cabral recorded his first multi-assist match. Rising FC, 1-3-3, plays its next match at home against San Antonio Football Club. With a 7 p.m. kickoff that can be seen on 3TV, AZFS, and ESPN Plus, and heard on KDUS 1060 AM English and La Onda 99.5 FM Spanish. And Arizona Women's Golf wins Big 12 Championship. ASU finishes runner-up. Number 19 Arizona Women's Golf won its first Big 12 title after outlasting number 8 Arizona State and number 30 Oklahoma State in a three-way playoff on April 17th. Arizona edged by ASU one stroke in the playoff to secure the win. ASU entered the day 11 strokes behind overall leader, number 30 Oklahoma State, and 5 strokes shy of number 19 Arizona. But the Sun Devils managed to finish with both teams by the end of the third round. ASU junior Beth Coulter fired a 66 in the third round, which tied conference medalist Kansas State's Sophie Burt for the best score on the day. And the tournament, she finished runner-up for the individual title. And the Cardinals are set to host annual Girls Flag Football Camp. The Arizona Cardinals will host the 5th annual Girls Flag Football Fundamentals Youth Camp on April 19th from 9 to 10:30 a.m. at the Cardinals Flag Football Campus at State Farm Stadium. The free camp provides girls ages 6 to 12 with the opportunity to learn the fundamentals of football. Participants will take part in flag football drills and interactive games. They will receive a camp t-shirt and lunch after the event. And finally, ASU Women's Basketball announces coaching staff for the 2025-26 season. New Arizona State Women's Basketball coach Molly Miller has assembled her coaching staff for the 2025-26 season. Miller's staff includes alum Stephanie Norman, who's been on the coaching staff at Louisville since 2007. Miller's staff also includes Daniel Barber, Jason Glover, Abby Olajuwon, Deja Bernard, and Ashley Lopez. Glover, Bernard, and Lopez previously were on GCU's coaching staff, with Glover as the associate head coach and Bernard and Lopez as assistants. You're listening to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. And time now for the columns and opinions section of today's Arizona Republic. We'll begin with E.J. Montini, columnist for the Arizona Republic. Trump says tomato tariff. We say Arizona is screwed. The Trump administration is withdrawing from an agreement on tomato imports from Mexico that will place a 21% tariff on the products. Arizona U.S. Representative Greg Stanton bluntly pointed out the problem with this. He wrote, "Trump's decision screws over Arizona. By ripping up this trade agreement, he'll cost our state's economy more than $3.4 billion. He'll put 22,000 plus Arizonans out of work, and he'll raise tomato prices by more than half at a time when we should be working to lower costs." Stanton is not alone. U.S. Senator Ruben Gallego wrote to Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick saying that the agreement is extremely important for the Arizona border communities. The tomato supply chain from Mexico supports 33,000 American jobs, including grocers, truckers, restaurants, warehouse operators, and others who move fresh tomatoes from the Nogales port to American consumers. The termination of this agreement puts these good-paying jobs at risk. This isn't just a couple of politicians blowing smoke. Arizona State University School of Agribusiness did a study trying to figure out what would happen if the tomato trade agreement was canceled. It found that business generated by the agreement accounted for about $3 billion in economic activity, roughly 20,000 jobs, and about $150 million in state and local taxes. Lance Youngmeyer, president of the Fresh Produce Association of the Americas, said, "If the administration opts to terminate this agreement, It will cause significant economic damage to countless communities in Arizona, Texas, and beyond, while also sending tomato prices skyrocketing for consumers across the country at a time when many American families are already struggling with the rising cost of living. The professor who led the ASU study, Timothy J. Richards, said, "Clearly, even the most optimistic scenario, tomato prices will rise substantially. All this because Trump wants to appear like a tough guy." Britton Mullen, president of the Border Trade Alliance, said that more than 400 businesses have written to the Department of Commerce, urging maintenance of tomato suspension agreements because there are too many jobs and there is too much economic activity connected to the tomato trade to sacrifice them for certain regional agricultural interests. Trump's Commerce Department, on the other hand, told the Wall Street Journal, "The current agreement has failed to protect U.S. tomato growers from unfairly priced Mexican imports. This action will allow U.S. tomato growers to compete fairly in the marketplace." This is a problem with tariffs. They often correct problems by creating new ones. It's like the old song, sort of. Trump says tomato, we say tomato, let's call the whole thing off. That was written by E.J. Montini. If you'd like to reach him, you can at ed.montini@arizonarepublic.com. Next opinion is written by Elvia Diaz, columnist for the Arizona Republic. "Pope Francis renewed my faith in the Catholic Church. My heart aches for a world without Pope Francis. His death on April 21st at 88 was inevitable, yet it is still shocking and painful for Catholics everywhere. Francis was the first Latin American pontiff to lead the Vatican. His language and cultural affinity were important, of course, but that wasn't what touched my heart during his 12-year papacy. It was Pope Francis's unwavering devotion to the poor, the sick, the persecuted, and the marginalized that gave me hope about humanity. He understood that those are the people around the world that need a voice, that need a helping hand, that need compassion. God knows we need a lot of that now more than ever. I'd never heard of him until March 2013 when he was announced as the 266th Pope. He replaced Pope Benedict the 16th, whose resignation had stunned the universe, but for whom I had no affinity. Immediately, Jorge Mario Bergoglio, who chose to be called Pope Francis after Francis of Assisi, captured my heart, my imagination, and my hope for a more progressive church, or at least a church that listened to people suffering over the usual politicking of the 2,000-year institution. I'm not the kind of Catholic that follows the Vatican's commands unquestioned. My daughter noticed as a teenager that I remained silent during our weekly Mass when the priest would pray for the end of contraception or other stances in which I disagreed. At some point, my daughter, who was attending Catholic school then, asked me why we went to Mass if I didn't believe in it. I'm not sure she bought my explanation. My faith, I told her, wasn't based on the Church itself. The Vatican is the institution that manages the faith and has historically done a terrible job by excluding women to the priesthood and often ignoring people's realities and suffering. Sunday Mass still gave me the spiritual connection I craved. The music, the smell of incense, and the prayer sent me into a trance that's hard to describe to non-believers. But some of the words uttered by the priest at the altar didn't resonate with my core beliefs. Something profound happened with Pope Francis. He exuded humility and compassion and committed himself to reforming the church to be inclusive instead of promoting the exclusion of people. He understood that times change, but humanity doesn't, or shouldn't, anyway. A lot has been written about his progressive bent, including his outreach to LGBTQ+ Catholics, his defense of immigrants, and his fight for the poor. Progressives, meanwhile, weren't entirely happy because they felt he should have done a lot more. But no other world leader has that kind of power over people's souls, Catholic or not, that he had. There's a reason why the most powerful men and women in the world made pilgrimage to the Vatican to get an audience with him. Circumstantially, the last one to get an official audience with Pope Francis a day before his death was U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance. The Trump administration had waved off the Pope's concerns over its deportation plans. Will Vance have a change of heart now that he was the last world leader to see Pope Francis? I won't hold my breath on Vance, but I hope we can build on Pope Francis's moral compass and renew our faith in humanity. That was written by Elvia Diaz. She's editorial page editor for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. You can reach her at Elvia, E-L-V-I-A, dot Diaz, D-I-A-Z, at ArizonaRepublic.com. The next column is written by Joanna Allhands for the Arizona Republic. Readers share their hacks to save at the store. As volatile egg prices dominated the headlines recently, we decided to take readers' temperature on food costs and the economy. Prices can vary widely among grocery stores, after all, so we asked for your intel. Sure enough, most readers reported higher egg prices, but other staples have noticeably impacted grocery bills. Butter is just about double from last year, Trader Joe's Linda Skinner of Phoenix reported. Frozen fish at Safeway is up about $2 a package. At Safeway, I mostly only buy things I cannot get at Trader Joe's, and it must be on sale. Several readers reported that they carefully watch sales, clip coupons, and find other creative ways to save money. Brand name soda is ridiculous, at $6.99 a six-pack and on sale for $4.25. John Eakins of Sun City West noted, "I buy store brands at $1.50 for 3 liters and put in 6 saved smaller bottles. Used to get brand names for $1.77 per six-pack on sale." Readers had plenty to say about the shape of the economy. "Not very optimistic," Pat Dickinson of Gilbert wrote. "I'm very disappointed that all the COVID changes never went away since the emergency supposedly ended. It's not very encouraging for any future worldwide events. I guess I should have known better than to get my hopes up." "We have the family dog driving the car," Dennis Novak of Santan Valley quipped. "The ditch is inevitable if we're not already there." But not all readers were so pessimistic. Virtually all indicators point to a robust economy from 2020 to 2024, Thomas Haladina of Phoenix wrote. "Trade deficits are irrelevant. Our GDP is very high. Inflation is a worldwide thing. The biggest factors in inflation are home and car insurance. Who's to blame for that? What about climate change? Might that account for the disasters that drive up insurance?" And she ends the column with asking, "What other issues should we ask readers to weigh in on? Email me about them." And the last opinion is written by Cody Hayes, guest columnist today. "Arizona uses water like there's no tomorrow. Big mistake. Opposing policy efforts have led to stalemate that protects profits over people. Arizona is in the midst of a water reckoning. The state's long-running illusion of endless growth, more data centers, more developments, more strawberries in the desert, collides daily with the basic reality of a finite water supply. The Colorado River is shrinking, groundwater levels are dropping, and in Phoenix, a new analysis shows more people are living without running water than ever before. The crisis isn't coming. It's already here. Industry has a role to play in shaping Arizona's water future. But the real question isn't whether companies can become more efficient. It's whether they can become more accountable, democratic, and willing to reckon with the limits of growth in a drying state. Intel's Ocotillo campus in Chandler is one of Arizona's major corporate water users. The company has made high-profile commitments to reuse and restore water, touting its net positive goals. But these pledges often obscure a harder truth. Industrial water use is still concentrated in high-growth, high-demand regions with limited supply and unequal access. Meanwhile, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, TSMC, is expanding in Phoenix with facilities that demand massive volumes of water for chip manufacturing and cooling. Arizona agriculture, which consumes 72% of the state's water, is similarly shielded from accountability. Groundwater pumping in rural Arizona remains largely unregulated, a problem worsened by real estate and agricultural lobbying that has derailed reform. Rather than face the root problem, overconsumption, we're distracted by flashy proposals to import Mississippi River water or build desalination plants in Mexico. These ideas sound bold, but they avoid the core question. Are we willing to confront the limits of growth in a drying region? Transparency must become the norm. Arizona needs binding statewide disclosure laws that track water use across the full life cycle of industrial activity, from chip manufacturing to alfalfa exports. We also can't let private philanthropy replace public responsibility. Arizona needs sustained investment in water recycling, rainwater harvesting, watershed restoration, indigenous-led stewardship. Efforts like the Nature Conservancy's Verde River partnerships are commendable, but they cannot substitute for statewide infrastructure and policy change. And finally, supply chains must shift toward regeneration, not extraction. Arizona's economy is optimized for short-term gain. Data centers built in floodplains, crops grown for export, tech hubs placed in cities already straining under heat and water stress. Consider this. Google's data center in Mesa has a permit to use up to 4 million gallons of water per day, roughly the daily use of 27,000 residents. Microsoft in Goodyear is estimated to consume around 56 million gallons annually, comparable to 670 households. We need a statewide blueprint for sustainability, with industry as a partner, not a free rider. In 2024, Phoenix's water quality report confirmed water met federal standards, but safe does not mean secure. Tiny but measurable amounts of PFAS, the so-called forever chemicals, also were detected in the city's water supply. Long-term exposure to PFAS may increase the risk of cancer and immune issues. Meanwhile, from the Navajo Nation to the Rio Verde foothills community north of Phoenix, some residents are trucking in drinking water, while corporate sites draw millions of gallons for chip plants and crops. As Governor Katie Hobbs has pushed for more urban-focused, conservation-driven water policy, Republican lawmakers have fought to preserve agricultural exemptions and development incentives. The result? A stalemate that protects profits over people. Meanwhile, the clock is ticking. Wells are drying. And if we continue to treat water as just another cost of doing business, we will find ourselves in a world where the market is thriving, but people are not. True leadership requires sacrifice. It's about relinquishing some control, some profit, some illusion that growth can continue forever. Because when the tap runs dry in Arizona, it won't be shareholder value we're thirsty for. It will be justice. And this was written by Cody Hayes. He's a PhD student at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Arizona State University. You can reach them at DJ Hayes, that's DJHAYS1, at asu.edu. And now to the horoscopes. If you're an Aries born March 21st to April 19th, have the confidence to go after a life-changing dream. Resistance can feel all-consuming. For Taurus, April 20th to May 20th, shining your light can be problematic if it shadows another. Watch for ego clashes. For Gemini, May 21st to June 21st, flying under the radar? Control dynamics in academic or legal matters may prompt you to sit this one out. For Cancer, June 22nd to July 22nd, your social circle may be changing. Are you questioning who you can trust? Prepare for hidden fears to arise. For Leo, professional partnerships can feel wrought with tension. Is your authority being challenged? Power imbalances quicken. For Virgo, August 23rd to September 22nd, stabilizing growth can break apart your embedded routines. A change of habit is forced. For Libra, September 23rd to October 23rd, reinventing how you identify with creativity? The sun activating Pluto can present a self-expression crisis. Be open to change. For Scorpio, October 24th to November 21st, a partnership may be unraveling your sense of security. Feel like you're losing control? Take a deep breath. For Sagittarius, November 22nd to December 21st, differing opinions? Prepare to butt heads over ideas when working with others today. rigid thinking creates a stalemate. For Capricorn, December 22nd to January 19th, your values are undergoing a transformational shift. Prioritize what you find satisfying and fulfilling. Ready to put your happiness first? And for Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th is a version of you coming to an end. The sun activating Pluto is akin to shedding old skin. For Pisces, February 19th to March 20th, fear of many unknowns may invade your mind. Relinquish illusions of control. Dear Abby, my oldest daughter, Alexa, is breaking my heart. She's engaged to a nice enough man that she's been with for 5 years, but she has cast aside every single wedding tradition that's important to us. Alexa won't wear an engagement ring because diamonds are ugly and not politically correct. She has refused to have either an engagement party or a bridal shower. Because they are foregoing a registry, my friends have no idea what to get them for wedding gifts. Turns out, none of my friends are invited to the wedding, only their friends and family. She refuses to have a bridal party, so her sisters are hurt because they wanted to be bridesmaids. I was so looking forward to shopping with her for a bridal gown, but she doesn't want to wear one. She bought a plain white dress instead. Worst of all, her father can't walk her down the aisle because, in her words, she's not property to be given away. There'll be no reception, just champagne and wedding cake in the basement of the church. There's no wedding dinner, not even appetizers, and no wedding toasts. There won't be a first dance because there's no band. I understand that she watched her younger sister turn into a bridezilla, but her sister did have a gorgeous wedding that we paid for. We're willing to pay for hers too, but she and her fiancé are refusing to do anything that we want. They're both doctors and can pay for whatever they want. Her father is ready to stay home rather than to be ignored, and I'm not sure I want to be there either. Please, how do we navigate this without alienating our daughter? Signed, Ruined Wedding in New York. Dear Ruined Wedding, you and your husband navigate this by reminding yourselves that Alexa's wedding is hers, not yours. You've already had two weddings, your own and your younger daughter's. Comfort yourselves with the knowledge that you and your husband can spend the money you would have blown on this shindig on a luxury vacation for yourselves. And dear Abby, what do you think about some relatives who asked to come and stay with us while they relocated to our state and brought a handgun and ammunition into our home without our knowledge? We have a 7-year-old daughter. They don't think they did anything wrong and claim they were not obligated to inform us because it was locked and the ammunition was stored apart from it. Signed, Threatened in Oregon. Dear Threatened, from what you've written, your relatives practice gun safety. Their weapon is locked and the ammunition is stored separately. I will assume that your child did not find or handle their weapon. That said, no one has the right to bring a gun into someone else's home without their permission. If your relatives can't immediately find other lodging, they should check what the Oregon gun laws are and consider storing their weapon away from your house in the trunk of their vehicle. And if you'd like to write to Dear Abby, you can at www.dearabby.com. And time for some comics. We'll start with Blondie. Dagwood's at work, and he's got this huge, flower arrangement with candy and stuff. It's a big basket, and he's walking over to a desk with a woman sitting behind a computer, and he says, "Marlene, my esteemed administrative assistant, thank you for being my first line of defense, like keeping clients on hold while I finish crunching numbers. You're welcome, sir. And I can't forget all the times you saved me from dithers." And she says, "I try." In Hagar the Horrible, Hagar walks home and tosses a box to Helga, his wife, and he says, "I got you a present, Helga." She opens it and says, "Oh, Hagar, it's a real diamond necklace." He says, "Well, if it's not, the Duke lied to the Duchess." In Baby Blues, Hammy is sitting on the couch, or sitting in kind of a beanbag chair, I guess, and his sister Zoe walks up and says, "What happened to walking around the house in your underwear season?" He says, "Mom called it off." "What?" She replaced it with something else. Listen to your mom or go without dessert season. And in pickles, the grandpa is sitting on the couch with his head back, eyes closed, with the dog asleep next to him. And his little grandson, Nelson, comes up and says, "Are you taking a nap, grandpa?" And he says, "A nap? Heck no. I'm pondering the imponderable." "Wow, grandpa," Nelson says. "That sounds like hard work." "Oh, yeah," he says. "And I'll probably have to take a nap when I'm done." And in Zitz, the mom and dad are sitting at the kitchen table. Mom has their computer and she's reading something, an article. Dad's drinking a cup of coffee and mom says, "Wow, the average household wastes around 30% of the groceries they buy." And in walks their son who screams, "Home, hungry, what is there to eat?" Mom gets up and says, "Well, meanwhile, at our house." And Dad sighs and says, "Remember leftovers?" And in Peanuts, Lucy talks to Charlie and comes up to him and says, "You know what? I'm doing a report for school on animals, and your stupid dog won't help me." And Snoopy's thinking, "How can I help? I don't know any animals." And before we finish up, let's take a look at what happened today in history. Today is Wednesday, April 23rd, the 113th day of 2025. There are 252 days left in the year. On this date in 1616, renowned playwright William Shakespeare died at Stratford-upon-Avon, England, at age 52. Shakespeare left a legacy of influential works that included 39 plays, 154 sonnets, and several narrative poems and verses. In 1635, on this date, the first public school opened in the United States, Boston's Latin School. The school was led by Philemon Pormont and intended to be a college preparatory center. Among its most famous alumni are John Hancock, William Hooper, and Samuel Adams. Benjamin Franklin attended as well, but dropped out. And on this date in 1861, General Robert E. Lee was appointed the commander of Virginia's Confederate forces during the Civil War. Lee resigned from the U.S. Army 3 days prior. In 1969, on this date, Sirhan Sirhan was sentenced to death for the June 5, 1968 assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy, the younger brother of President John Kennedy. His sentence was later commuted to life in prison. And we've reached the end of the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss any part of a program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, under broadcast info and audio.